Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. This is the concluding session in this series of discussions, our program, that asks guests to talk about their home, their work, and their ideas about this place, California. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute, the not-for-profit research and education center here on the coast. This morning, we will be talking to Nelson Lichtenstein, the MacArthur Foundation Professor of History at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Professor Lichtenstein teaches in a number of fields, including U.S. history and U.S. labor history. He's a graduate of Dartmouth College and UC Berkeley. He's the author of many books, including a biography of Walter Reuther, The Most Dangerous Man in Detroit, and the award-winning The State of the Union, A Century of American Labor, and more recently, The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. So, Professor Lichtenstein, Nelson, is that okay?
That's fine.
Good morning, Nelson.
Glad to be here.
And it's good for you to join us. Nelson, I hope you don't mind if I ask you a question, first of all, about yourself. It's kind of become routine in this series to ask people about how they got interested in the work that they do. And so you're a historian. Perhaps just a word about your craft.
Well, right. Well, I'm 68 years old, so that tells you that I got into this in the 60s and 70s. And I went to Berkeley. I was excited about going to, my parents were my father owned a local, owned kind of a little business, a little five and dime store in Frederick, Maryland. But he'd been a refugee from Germany, so he was a kind of social democrat. And my mother was a kind of rebel from the Deep South, so she was... She fled the Deep South. Anyway, although Maryland was sort of the Upper South. Anyway, so I grew up there, and then I went to college, and I was very interested in the civil rights movement, of course. And then I went to University of California at Berkeley, which was, in 1966, very obviously very exciting place. And there I got interested in the labor history, the labor movement, and I was in radical politics, and this was a period when sort of the early 70s, when sort of the new leftists of all sorts, some went off to factories, some just became academics, but they, kind of the turn toward studying and being active in the labor movement. So I also did that. I actually discussed that in greater detail in one of my first book, which was called Labor's War at Home, which was a study of the industrial unions in World War II. And so anyway, so I studied that, and those of us who study labor do so, not sort of in a kind of anthropological or antiquarian fashion, but because we think that there's something. That a powerful labor movement is a progressive force in society, in all societies, and therefore we're interested in why it succeeds and why it fails at various moments over the last 200 years. So I did that, and then I kept my hand in doing that, and then, another big book, I wrote this biography of Walter Reuther, who most people under the age of, well, now 50 at least, probably don't know who he is, but he was the...
His daughter's a neighbor of ours on the coast.
I may well have interviewed her 20 years ago, right?
Linda, right.
Yeah, right. Anyway, he was the head of the United Automobile Workers in a period from in the 40s and 50s and 60s when it was by far the most powerful union in the country, or one of the most powerful, and also a union that was... where politics was very, very lively, and Reuther was both celebrated and condemned for various political things he did. But so that was very interesting. I thought, well, I've got to write a biography of this guy, and I did. It took me a long time to do it. My hair turned white in the course of it, but I did, and I was very happy to do that. And so anyway, I kept my hand in that. But what happens in sort of in terms of studying labor, you can't really study labor in isolation from politics, economics, world capitalism, intellectual life, all sorts of things, gender and race as well, of course. So I found that that my interests broadened out, and that became manifested in the last book I wrote, which was on Walmart, which, you know, here's a nod. I mean, organized labor plays no explicit role at Walmart, but, it's a powerful company which is shaping the nature of work in America and around the world. So I thought this was another way to get at some of these questions, even though, you know, I wasn't going to be studying trade unions or trade union leaders or things of that sort. So I enjoyed doing that. And that's kept me... So I find myself writing about... and then ideas, too, that because C. Wright Mills, the great sociologist, once sort of put it, the labor metaphysic, that was what he referred to in the late 40s. What he meant by that was that sense that labor is something special. It's a potential vanguard, you know, in society. You know, this derives from Marx and before Marx. Well, Mills said, well, the labor metaphysic is sort of, you know, gone. He was saying that in the 50s. But so what he was really saying was the idea of a organized labor movement. I found myself interested in that and what various intellectuals have said about that over the years. So that's where I come from. Right now, I'm very happy to be here back in California after 20 or 30 years in the East teaching there. And here at UC Santa Barbara, we have a Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy, which has speakers and the labor studies minor and, you know, recruits grad students and things. So I'm still sort of doing that.
Okay, great. But that takes us right to a slightly off-point question that I wanted to ask you. But just following up on the recent elections, we've had several speakers from UC in the series and a lot of worrying about the future of the institution. What's your take on UC and education in California? Are we going to be helped, do you think, by the passage of Proposition 30?
Well, we held a little bit. Certainly, that's for sure. I mean, you know, a little bit, we will be. There are two issues, I think, really. One is, you know, is the money there, you know, to support the university system and the state university system and the junior colleges and education in general. And here, is the money there? Will it be there in the next 5-10 years? I think we can offer a somewhat more optimistic reading than we could. You know, a few years ago, that is, yes, taxpayers did decide to vote Proposition 30, which would, I think, provide a total of $6 billion, I think, in general money. And then, probably much more important than Prop 30, is that it looks as if, you know, it just finally, you know, the normal business cycle, although much delayed and much sort of tepid, nevertheless, is finally turning. And there, you know, there will be more employment and more production and more sales and et cetera in the state of California and around the country as well. So that the state will benefit from that. So that there'll be some money there available. If a boom, there'll actually be a good deal of it. So that's one side, but that's not the whole answer. The other side is there a will? Do people want to support the University of California as it was conceived, both first as a land-grant college, which was to be free, and then as Clark Kerr kind of refounded it in the 1960s, and expanded, you know, multi-campus. And that's much more up in the air because there's a general movement to a de facto privatize higher education in the United States, and in some ways the regents, have bought into that. And in one sense, they would rather run their own shop. The fact is, all of these universities, the public higher education, are they're excellent universities, and therefore, if you want to kind of go the way of the market, you know. Can you charge tuition at University of Virginia? I taught there, or Michigan, or California. Can you jack up tuition twice or double or triple? Or, you know, the answer is yes, sure. The market will bear that. There are lots of upper middle class people all around the country who are happy to pay, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a year in tuition to have their kids go to one of the, you know, the really good state universities. And so, yeah, and the regents and here in California and otherwhere, they say, well, that's an easier way to do it than to always dick around with the state legislature and things of that sort. Let's just use the market. So I think they like privatization. And then I think it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that is, insofar as these state universities do become kind of elite institutions, then the public support for them declines, independent of whether there's actually money exists. They'll spend the money on something else. So I think that requires a fight. That fight is going to go on, even if the treasury of the state is doing better. But I think that whole question. And I would just say one thing. In the course of my work, I've looked at Clark Kerr as a figure, the president of the university between I think 58 I think and 67. And I've looked at him. Partly, I was interested in him because he was a labor economist in the 40s and the 30s and 40s, and then an educational leader. And Kerr, of course, has sort of these two sides to him. On the one hand, Kerr was very much, he was a social democrat. He was a New Dealer. He did think that, you know, public higher education was a public good. He was very much in favor of. Of a tuition-free system of state universities that were funded by the legislature, and that made him kind of, at least in today's terms, very much a liberal. And in fact, by the way, his great antagonist at the university, you know, in kind of symbolic terms, was Mario Savio, the famous student leader back in the 60s. And, you know, Kerr always thought Savio wanted to destroy the university. He was wrong about that, but putting that aside, it turns out when by the time Savio and Kerr died, Savio in the 90s and Kerr in, I think, 2003 or 4, they were both on the same side of the barricades. I mean, they were both defending the university and defending low tuition and defending public higher education, so they ended up agreeing. Now, the other thing about Kerr, let me just say, and I think this is a part of the issue with the university today. The other side of Kerr was that he was, in a way, almost Pollyannish in his optimism about the economic system, the parallelism or the interpenetration of the modern corporation and the modern university. And he thought that, he famously was criticized in the 60s by Mario Savio and others for saying, well, the university is just sort of a service station to society. You know, it's just, it's going to, you know, welcome, you know, it's going to do all these things for modern industry. And Savio and other student radicals said, well, we're just being a handmaiden to these fat cats. But Kerr's, I think he was wrong, but he was not just a kind of a, what should I say, he was not just a sort of a head-in-the-sand kind of guy. He thought, and his generation of liberals thought, that capitalism was sort of moderating itself, had been sanded off capitalism. In fact, he did not use that word. He used the word industrialism. And he thought that, the Soviet Union is becoming industrial, the U.S. is industrial, it's a complicated, world, skilled knowledge is at a premium, and that's also what the corporation is all about. So he thought that rather than having the university become like the corporation, he thought the corporations would be more like the university. That is, they put aside profit motives, they put aside sort of the scramble for the dollar, and they would become kind of knowledge industries. So, I mean, I think he was wrong about that, but that was the logic of his thought. Anyway, so I think that today we're actually seeing that it's very clear that some say Silicon Valley and some of the the really high-tech industries, which Kerr thought, oh, they'll really need the university. I mean, so they will help, you know, be sustaining the university because this is a knowledge society. But in fact, it turns out that Silicon Valley sees itself kind of, you know, they just need a few kind of brilliant entrepreneurs and, sort of the Steve Jobs kind of figure, often college dropouts, in fact, and they don't really need the university, and they're willing, you know, so that kind of support for the university has declined.
And just one little side issue there. What about the issue of or the point of quality that we're all mixed up on these days? I mean, are we going to get the line seems to be that you want quality, you pay for it. So how would that fit into the way you've looked at UC and California education?
I mean, partly, I mean, I have to say, what's quality? I mean, there's prestige and sort of your pecking order in the U.S. news reports, you know, on the best universities, and that's kind of a, you know, status hierarchies and things of that sort. I'm not so interested in that. But, you know, there's quality also means, you know, having low class sizes and having a university that's open to, you know, the entire population of the state. Kerr's solution to that, he was very much an elitist in a way, a meritocratic elitist. So he thought, okay, you know, the master plan, which he put together, was, okay, the UC will give the PhD, only admit the top 12.5%. Then the state colleges will be in the middle. They'll admit the top 30%. And then the community colleges will be open admission. But I mean, and so that was very elitist. But the thing that sort of was social democratic about it, that was kind of liberal about it, was that there'll be a very easy transfer among people from the community colleges and the state colleges into the UCs, and that meant that in fact the whole system would be open, and a lot of mobility. That, because of money problems, didn't turn out to be the case, and so the UC, the PhD granting University of California, is somewhat isolated, and then places like. Well, then the various campuses, and especially Berkeley and UCLA and probably San Diego, say, well, you know, we're good enough. We can just raise money privately. We'll remain excellent, you know, high quality. And, you know, to heck with admitting or serving the population of the state of California. Let's get more people from China and from the East and, you know, around. And, you know, you can have a great university, you know, but it isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's not the original idea of a land-grant university serving the interests of the mass of the population, or even Clark Kerr's vision, that is missing. So quality, I'd say, quality for its own sake, I'm not so excited about. But I am interested in having a good university which will serve, you know, the entire population of the state.
Okay, thanks. This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host this morning. Today we're talking to Professor Nelson Lichtenstein. He's he's a professor of history at the University of California in Santa Barbara. You've used the term social democrat, Nelson, several times. I wonder if just for some of our listeners' sake, could you give us a definition of what you think a labor movement is, and then maybe a left, right, and center? What's a social democrat, and why do you use that in the context of labor movements?
Well, I think that word works. It's a little bit of an old-fashioned word, but sometimes some old-fashioned words are good. That is, it means linked to the sort of the New Deal, or the labor governments of Great Britain after the war, meaning based on government that will institute a welfare state, meaning not just welfare, of course, but Social Security and national health insurance and mass higher education, and then the constituents of people who support that are are often a strong labor movement and also a kind of strong liberal, progressive sort of elements of the population. And that's what I use that phrase, social democratic, distinguishing from populist, which today populist tends to have a kind of right-wing flavor, a kind of enraged hostility to, yes, sometimes bankers, but just as easily immigrants and academic, the universities, et cetera. So the term populist, which used to be part of the left, today is more often part of the right-wing nomenclature. It's social democratic, not socialist. The main plank is not the expropriation of property, by the government or the working class. It's going to manage capitalism, but in a kind of ameliorative fashion. And I think that Clark Kerr would have been sort of somewhat of a social democrat, even in a sense. He was always I do think he's an interesting figure. He had a phrase. He said he was a mild figure. He was a Quaker. He was not a radical in any way, shape, or form. He said, in the past, we've had a class conflict, and we've had blood in the streets. But in the future, we'll continue to have conflict between classes, but instead of blood flowing in the street, the memos will flow between the bureaucracies. What that implies is you would have a strong labor movement, which would kind of negotiate in one way or another for the interests of a working class. Now, in terms of the labor movement,
of course, Ronald Reagan didn't really agree with him.
Ronald Reagan fired Clark Kerr, he fired him because he thought, Kerr was too soft on the student radicals at Berkeley. But actually, the actual issue that he was fired on was raising tuition at UC, and Kerr was against that. Now, the labor movement itself, in the United States, it's a complicated variegated kind of institution with all sorts of types in it, and some very self-conscious about forming alliances with other progressive groups, and others. Other elements of the labor movement less so. I would say this. This is my general perspective, that given the institutional weakness of the unions, of all unions, left, right, and center. They are all weak. That's a function of people like Reagan and the conservatism and the failure of the labor law to make it easy for unions to organize people. As a result of that, in the last 20 years, almost all the unions have sort of taken a little kind of jump to the left. That is, linking themselves with immigrants, immigrant aspirations, with the interests of women and gay people, and of course, African Americans, in a way that was not the case, back in the 50s or 60s or 70s. And I think that's partly out of weakness. They think they need allies, and so there's at least in rhetorical terms, most unionists have that kind of sense of where they stand. The labor movement today stands kind of on the center left of American politics, in a way that back in the Vietnam era, when it was a strong supporter of the war in Vietnam, it sort of stood on the center right. At least in terms of the most important issue of that day.
Okay. I see that you've written a book about Walmart. It's kind of not just mm-hmm. a story of labor, but I suppose connected. But first of all, how did you get interested in Walmart? What do you think is interesting in the story of Walmart?
Well, around in the late 90s, I'd always been interested in General Motors. That's the biggest company in America. That's, what's good for General Motors is good for the U.S., said the head of General Motors in the 50s. So I was interested in that, obviously, auto company. And then I noticed sometime in the late 90s that Walmart employed more workers than General Motors. That's interesting. where'd that come from? And this little southern company, it was growing very rapidly in the late 90s. And then, actually, when Walmart was first admitted to the Fortune 500 list of biggest companies in terms of sales. This happened in 1996. Bingo, Walmart became number four right away, and then it became number one by 2001. I thought, well, you got to study the commanding heights of the economy. And, well, you know, the biggest firms, you should know something about them. You can't ignore them, regardless of where they're from or what they do. And then, but then mainly what happened was, I was out here in Santa Barbara. I'd arrived for a couple years, and all of a sudden there's this strike that takes place in Southern California by the grocery workers against, the strike was against Albertsons and Vaughn's and Ralph's. And the reason the strike happened, this is the fall of 2003, the reason the strike happened was that these companies had, you know, just read the papers, and Walmart had announced that it was going to put 40 super centers in, you know, metropolitan California, mainly in Los Angeles. These are the big stores that sell groceries as well as everything else. So they thought, okay, we have to cut wages and cut benefits in order to compete with Walmart. So they took a very hard line on the negotiations in 2003, and then a strike took place in the fall. Actually, it was a lockout in part for, I think, one of the companies, but it was a strike. Well, the union didn't do a very good job explaining why there was this strike, really, in for a variety of reasons. And reporters started calling me up. And, you know, and I it was obvious they were, you know, Walmart was the 800-pound gorilla that was not quite in the negotiating room, but it was there, right outside. And I got interested in that. And then one of the head of the Humanities Center here said, Nelson, why don't you have a debate with Walmart on this? And I said, well, maybe. I don't know if that's going to work. But what we had was a conference, actually, on Walmart. It was a very successful conference. A book came out of it. And I got interested in it. And then this was a moment in 2004 and 5. There was a lot of hysteria about the company, really, at that particular moment. So I decided to write a larger book about it. But that it came out of that strike. And obviously, I mean, just as General Motors at one time, or the Pennsylvania Railroad before that, these big corporations sort of, you know, they encapsulated the politics and the social strains of a whole society. Today, that's true of Walmart in every which way. So it still remains, you know, to study that company is to study United States and both capital and labor in the United States, even if the labor is unorganized in the case of Walmart.
Can you back up and give us a bit of detail about what you mean when you say to study Walmart is to study the United States?
Well, I mean, yeah, Walmart has 1.4 million employees in the U.S., and so it sets the sort of pattern for many, many other employees in the retail sector. So just the other day, I mean, I've known this, but Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times had a very good article that appeared in the Times about part-time work, about the proliferation of involuntary part-time work. And, you know, what you have, this is true at Walmart and every other big box store, is that the companies, of course, want to only employ workers when they're needed, when the sales flow is heavy, or when the customers come in. And so Walmart has developed very sophisticated software, which every store manager uses now, in which to tell the workers, you know, we know we'll need you between noon and 2, but so come in, you know, for 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day, but we don't need you otherwise to go home. So we'll give you 12 or 14 hours of work a week, and maybe if you're really good and things turn out right, we'll give you 22 hours of work. So, you know, they can vary they have very precise ways of varying the hours of work. Well, this has now become rife throughout the whole American workplace. That I think in the contemporary recovery, something like one third of all the jobs are part time. And the number of involuntary part-time jobs has gone way up. We're talking about several million workers. And so Walmart's one of the leaders of this, and so everyone else copies them. Today, I don't think of Walmart as unique. I mean, their executives have gone off and gotten jobs with Target and vice versa. So it's like any mature company, its techniques, its policies, its patterns of work have been copied when they're, you know, by their competitors. So, you know, that's just one example. So today we face this problem of tremendous number of people. We're talking about at least 8 million who are part-timers. They don't want to be part-timers. They want to be, they'd rather work full-time. Well, that's a lot of people, and that's growing. And it's even true in the university, and it's true in state employment, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles. They can use the same software to tell workers to come in just a few hours a week. So it's very efficient from the point of view of the firm, but it creates havoc in the lives of the workers. And I would say that most people think that when you think about what are the grievances of workers at Walmart, low wages. Okay, yeah, that's true, low wages, but that's not the main grievance. It's this insecurity and sort of chaotic sort of pattern to their work hours that just makes life miserable for them and for their kids and et cetera. All the things that anybody has to do in life, they just can't predictably plan their lives. And I think that's one of the major, that's the major grievance of Walmart workers right now.
I think a lot of the opposition, there's been a lot up here in Northern California and in our county to Walmart, has been framed in consumer terms. Lately, there's been more interest in the workers themselves and the possibility of them organizing and the possibility of using, I guess, new strategies for organizing workers. How about that? Inside organizing, outside organizing, non-majority?
Right. Well, the United Food and Commercial Workers, which is the labor group most concerned about Walmart, has created an organization called Our Walmart, which I think stands for Organization for Respect, at Walmart, something like that. And it's both, a creature of the UFCW, but also somewhat independent. And it's not designed to be a union. It's designed to be just an organization that speaks on behalf, but actually is composed of working Walmart associates, so-called, and, which they have their own voice and which, they bring to the public, all sorts of concerns that Walmart workers have. And I've always thought that if you actually hear Walmart workers themselves, that's very powerful. Here at UC Santa Barbara, we had a workshop last March in which several academics came who the point of which was to learn how to write op-eds. We also had four Walmart workers who came through Our Walmart, the organization, and they were also learning how to write op-eds. And it was very powerful to have them here. I mean, they're the ones who are every day, they have to go to work and deal with all the hassles and humiliations. And I think that, that's far more moving and graphic and important than having the statistics of wage levels, although that's important. But I think to actually put a face on these Walmart workers and have them speak up, that's very important. And I think that's what Our Walmart is doing.
This may be connected as well, Nelson, but a big part of the economy here in California is connected with the big ports, and the ports are connected with massive inland distribution warehousing centers, and Walmart itself is connected to that in terms of, is it just-in-time sort of delivery and stocking and so forth? A big divide there, it seemed to me, between the waterfront workers and the others, but it hasn't always been that way. Looked into the whole issue of the containerization of transportation and so forth. How about a word on that?
Right. Well, we had a whole conference on containerization here about 5 years ago, actually co-sponsored by the art department, which was just fascinated by these containers as sort of objects that could be, torn apart and put together in different ways, and so it's kind of an odd, interesting collection. But containerization is an amazing phenomena, which you know, it's very simple in one sense. I mean, it's not a computer. It's just standardize the big boxes and standardize the ships and then standardize the ports, and then it made it much cheaper to get stuff from China and everywhere else. Let me points about this. I just an hour ago on this campus attended a lecture on a very kind of optimistic lecture on the wonderful things about new technology that's now, you know, through our iPhones and everything else is happening. And, you know, sitting there, yes, this is all wonderful, great new technologies coming down, but the question is who will win the or capture the benefits of this enormous productivity that is taking place in certainly the electronic world. And as it stands now, it's in fact not the workers. But one of the few examples where workers did capture some of the benefits of that was the ports of the West Coast, where longshoremen, you know, there are only about 13,000 of them, I think, all up and down the West Coast, but they can earn, you know, $150,000 a year. I mean, they deserve it because there's this incredibly productive system of getting stuff from around the world, and they've just gotten a little bit their share, that's all. It's still much cheaper to take a ton of stuff from China than it was 50 years ago, but the longshoremen have gotten part of that. So that's an example of one of the few examples in American society today where blue-collar workers have actually captured some of the enormous productivity gains that have taken place as a result of new technology. Now, you just move 50 miles inland from the port of L.A. or Oakland, for that matter, and you find this massive distribution center complex. And here, the workers are dealing with the same stuff, containers, basically taking the stuff out of the containers and putting them in the trucks. But it's very highly highly automated, these distribution centers. And there, the workers are earning $12 an hour or $14 an hour part-time, and they never know exactly where they're coming to work. And so clearly there's an instance where these workers have not reaped the productivity dividend. And furthermore, the other feature of this world of distribution, it's true of retail in general, is that these distribution centers are not owned by Walmart or by Target or by... They're subcontracted. And then there are subcontractors who get labor who are also subcontractors. So you have a layer of subcontractors. So a worker there, typically but Latino, by the way, never knows who they're actually working for, you know, one week to the next. These sort of subcontractors come and go. The Walmart has the ultimate responsibility, or Target will have the ultimate responsibility, but they are not legally responsible for the employment relations. So it makes it much difficult for the workers to organize and sometimes even get paid, because some of these subcontractors just abscond, you know, with the payroll. So here you have a phenomenally sophisticated distribution system, but really a mid-Victorian system of labor relations, and that is taking place throughout the society. And the reason we call a lot of workplaces sweatshops, it's not that the workers are actually sweating, or even that they're cramped and unhealthful. It's that, like the Victorian era garment trade, you have a series of subcontractors who parcel out the labor, and that's what you have in electronics today, in distribution, in Amazon that does the same thing with their distribution centers. So does FedEx, et cetera, et cetera. We have a proliferation of bright, shiny sweatshops.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. Today's program is talking about California. Our guest is Professor Nelson Lichtenstein. He's the MacArthur Foundation Professor of History at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's the author of many books. We've been talking about several of them. They include his biography of Walter Reuther, The Most Dangerous Man in Detroit, his another book, The State of the Union, A Century of American Labor, and more recently, the topic we've just discussed, The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. Well, just thinking about your last point, FedEx and so forth, that it is possible to organize workers in these sectors. Yeah, United Parcel Service is organized. How did that happen? What's the issue?
Well, of course, UPS was an older firm. The Teamsters organized, and I think back in the 50s or 40s and 50s, and then UPS became very successful, like FedEx. FedEx is non-union, UPS is union. I think one of the differences between UPS and FedEx is that UPS, the trucks, are owned by the company. And so the truck drivers are employees of UPS, which means they have, they are formed into unions and they negotiate, and they had a very successful strike in 1997. And they, they keep up at least pressure on UPS. FedEx is non-union, and FedEx, although very highly technologically advanced, they've chosen to make almost most of the trucks that you see, the ones with the color, what's red and blue, they all look the same. But they are not owned by FedEx. They're subcontracted, and they're owner operators. And so, therefore, the people running around delivering the stuff are not technically employees of FedEx, although I think de facto they are, but they aren't technically. And therefore, they have no recourse. They can't organize themselves. They can't, in fact, it would be illegal for them to link up these owner-operators, to link up together to fight FedEx. That would be considered a violation of the antitrust law. So FedEx is, many, many companies use subcontracting and owner-operators and independent contractors as a way of getting around the labor law. And they basically, these are employees of the company, but they're legally independent operators, and therefore, they have to pay their own health insurance and all those things, and they can't organize. So that's one of the problems. And FedEx has been very politically active in a right wing fashion, trying to maintain that system.
Well, talking with you, Nelson, I guess I know this probably from way back. You'd like to see labor stronger, I think. You'd like to see
the
organizations more active, more democratic, more significant. So we've had some interesting startups in the past year or so. I think of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. California Healthcare Workers, mm-hmm. Longview, Washington, mm-hmm. Chicago Teachers. How do you understand these kind of movements? What importance do you see in them?
Well, I mean, I think they indicate, and there were many before this as well, and back in the 90s and 80s, we have not lacked for militant and creative strikes and organizing drives in this country in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. It's not that that there's been a kind of passivity. That it happened every year. There's something of that sort. I think this year maybe the most interesting was the Chicago teacher strike. So they exist. And I've often thought, why is it that here we remember, for example, the Homestead strike of 1892, or we remember the 1919 steel strike, or we remember the Memphis sanitation strike of 1968. Some of those were successes, some are failures. I think the reason that some strikes have a kind of larger meaning is because they seem to speak to the whole country, society as a whole, and that's partly the role that intellectuals and journalists and people like that sort of explain why they're important. So I think, for example, the Chicago teacher strike in September was important because it was making a statement not about money. The actual amount of money that the teachers wanted was a second-rate question. The real issue was, and the union was striking for this, was to maintain a public education system in the city of Chicago against the wishes of Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, and others kind of, and this sort of so-called reform group, you know, partly kind of billionaires like Bill Gates, and partly and the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, and others, which are sort of essentially trying to dismantle the public education system in the United States. And so that's what the strike was about, a public education system. And I think it was successful because that word got out, and it had a lot of community support. And you know, it's strikes of that sort and organizing drives of that sort, and a number of strikes actually are quite low in the United States these days, that I think that labor will survive and prosper, and it's trying to do that. The message gets muddled often because there have been, like in the healthcare, something you know very well, in the California healthcare, there's been a big division and divisive conflict going on there, you know, which is, I think, has been extremely unhelpful and tragic even. But in general, I think the unions are making this effort. Now, what they're up against is, of course, corporate hostility across the board, corporate hostility to unions. But also, and unfortunately, we have a situation where millions of otherwise pro-union people just have had so little contact with unions, because unions are so weak these days, and so few members that they don't really know what a union is. I mean, they have no idea what a union is, and so that, you know, means there's a kind of huge education task. I find in my labor history class, I'm doing more just explaining what collective action means, you know, you know, something maybe 20 years ago I wouldn't have to have done. So I think that's part of the task ahead of us. Now, let me just, one last little thing before we end here.
Well, we got a few minutes left.
Okay, so. The Obama's victory, which I, of course, was delighted, I was happy that he won re-election from my point of view. One remarkable thing about it was, despite there was this big upheaval in Wisconsin and Ohio, there was a big mobilization to defend union rights. Obama said nothing about that in the campaign. And from his point of view, there was a good reason, because he wanted to win the state of Virginia. He wanted to win Florida. He wanted to win North Carolina. These were states where unions were non-existent, and there was a kind of general anti-union sentiment. So he chose not to educate the American public about the need for unionism or why it's legitimate in the course of his campaign. He did spend time educating the American public about why you needed higher taxes on the rich. I think he did that fairly well. But he said absolutely nothing about unions. And I think what that raises the specter is, could we be entering a period of American history where we have liberalism without labor? I mean, is that possible? We have a liberal, you know, I mean, Obama's in favor of his health care plan and liberal and the reform of immigration and raising taxes on the rich and maybe other things, too, that are good. But the labor movement just fades away into the sunset. I'm not sure that's possible. I think the labor movement's always been the backbone of liberalism, of progressivism in the United States, I'm not sure that's possible. And certainly, it will be a dangerous experiment if you try to do it. But I think that progressives, although welcoming Obama's re-election, should also recognize that at least history shows that you can't have genuinely progressive governments or even democratic governments and polities without a labor movement in existence. So I think that's pretty important.
And going back to the teachers, you know, it's kind of striking that in a country which once really valued a public education system, we see what you're talking about, the idea of privatization, but also a widespread attack on teachers. You're a teacher.
Yep, yep.
What's going on here? Why pick on teachers? And
right.
You know,
I think partly it is. I mean, actually, a little less so on the university level. There's a certain, but I mean, the public school. What's remarkable is the public school system. Partly it is that this this sort of neoliberal so-called reform has chosen to delegitimize. I think what they're really trying to do is to delegitimize public education in general, and therefore they create a kind of a the mythic kind of poor school teacher who doesn't care. This is a myth that's been created and structured, and I think it's very deleterious, very bad. In the recent issue of The New Yorker, there's an excellent profile of Diane Ravitch, who is today a firm advocate of public education and a strong backer of the teachers' unions and of teachers in general. She had been, 25 years ago, a kind of neoconservative, a kind of a very critical of public education, and for a lot of reasons, she came to the conclusion that the so-called reformers, who want to create charter schools and private schools, were simply wrong, and really, they had their main agenda was not so much the improvement of education, but was the dismantling of one of the building blocks of a kind of democratic society, which is the system of public education. That's one of the great features of American democracy, beginning in the antebellum era and led by abolitionists and other progressives of that moment. And there's an effort to dismantle that. The Walden Foundation, I should say, is in the forefront of that. They give lots of money to these schools that are seeking to get out from under, to break away from the public education system.
Okay, Nelson, I think you told me you have to rush off to another appointment. Just yes. one last quick one. There's still 6 million, I think, or so union members in the state of California. What should they watch for? What should they look at in terms of, what might be happening in the period coming up?
Well, that's a good question. Here is the most important thing I think that would happen. And one reason that California is a blue state, does vote for the Democrats and sort of, is that throughout the state, but in Los Angeles in particular, the labor movement is led by Latinos, Hispanics, and I think that's true to some extent public the health field, public employment, and hospitals and hotels. But there's a lot, many, many more Mexican Americans, Hispanics who can be organized and who work in light industry, and et cetera. And I think that if we're going to see the revival of the union movement, certainly in California, I think we want to look to the Latino population in the world of both the service sector and a lot of the light manufacturing, where they're also there. And I think that this moment, we may see a renewal of that, especially as the economy gets better.
Right. Well, thanks very much, Nelson. Nelson Lichtenstein. This is Talking About California. We've been talking to Professor Lichtenstein, who, again, is the professor of history at the University of California in Santa Barbara, the author of many books. You can look him up and find out more about his book on his own website and on the university website. Nelson, many thanks. It's been informative and very helpful.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Good luck to you. Thanks. And again, thanks to our listeners for tuning in, and I want to say thanks to the KZYX staff, and especially to Mary Agner. I'm Cal Winslow. I've been hosting this series, Talking About California, and I hope that we'll be able to come back sometime. And finally, thanks to the Mendocino Institute, which has helped to keep me going. Talking About California, here we go. Goodbye. Hope to talk to you again soon.